her that makes me fearless with the truth. Her eyes widen, and she shivers slightly. "You're impossible," she says.
"It's possible," I say.
She laughs, and her black eyes sparkle at me. "What should we do now?" she asks. I need to get my hair cut, and I need to get the pouch and deposit slips to my dad. I want to do neither of these things. What I want to do is find someplace cozy and cozy up with her. But the pouch needs to be delivered. I ask her if she's up for a trip to Harlem, and she agrees. Really, this is the absolute last thing I should be doing. If there are worse ideas than this, I don't know what they are. My dad's just going to freak her out. She's going to meet him and imagine that he's what I'll be like in 50 years, and then she'll go flying for the hills because that's what I would do in her place. My dad's a weird guy. I say weird, but what I mean is epically fucking strange. First, he doesn't really talk to anyone except customers. This includes me and Charlie. Unless berating counts as talking. If berating counts, then he said more to Charlie this past summer and fall than he has in 19 years. I may be exaggerating, but only slightly. I don't know how I'm going to explain Natasha to him or Charlie. Well, Charlie I don't really care about, but my dad will notice her. He'll know something's up in the same way he always knows which customer is going to shoplift or who's good for an IOU and who's not. Later tonight at dinner, he'll say something to my mom in Korean in the voice he uses to complain about Americans. I don't really want either of them involved in this yet. We're not ready for that kind of pressure. Natasha says that all families are strange, and it's true. I'll have to ask her more about her family later after we do this thing. We descend into the subway. "Get ready," I say.
Harlem is only a 25-minute subway ride from where we were, but it's like we've gone to a different country. The skyscrapers have been replaced by small, closely packed stores with bright awnings. The air smells brighter, less like a city and more like a neighborhood. Almost everyone on the street is black. Daniel doesn't say anything as we walk along Martin Luther King Boulevard toward his parents' store. He slows down when we pass by an empty storefront with a huge "for rent" sign and a pawn shop with a green awning. Finally, we stop in front of a black hair care and beauty supply store. It's called Black Hair Care. I've been into lots of these. "Go down the street to the beauty supply and pick up some relaxer for me," says my mother every 2 months or so. It's a thing. Everyone knows it's a thing how all the black hair care places are owned by Koreans, and what an injustice that is. I don't know why I didn't think of it when Daniel said they owned a store. I can't see inside because the windows are covered with old, sun-faded posters of smiling and suited black women, all with the same chemically treated hairstyle. Apparently, according to these posters at least, only certain hairstyles are allowed to attend board meetings. Even my mom is guilty of this kind of sentiment. She wasn't happy when I decided to wear an afro, saying that it isn't professional looking. But I like my big afro. I also liked when my hair was longer and relaxed. I'm happy to have choices. They're mine to make. Next to me, Daniel is so nervous he's vibrating. I wonder if it's because I'm going to meet his dad, or because of the politics of his parents owning this store. He faces me and tugs his tie from side to side, as if it's been too tight this whole time. "So my dad's really..." He stops and starts again. "And my brother's really..." His eyes are everywhere except on mine. And his voice is strained, probably because he's trying to speak without breathing. "Maybe you could just wait out here," he says, finally getting an entire sentence out. At first, I don't really think anything of it. I figure everyone's embarrassed by their family. I'm embarrassed about mine. Well, my father, at least. In Daniel's place, I'd do the same thing. My cheating ex, Rob, never met my father. It was just easier. No listening to my father's too thick, fake American accent. No watching him try to find an opening so he can talk about himself and all his plans for the future and how he's going to be famous one day. We're standing just in front of the store when two black teenage girls walk out laughing with each other. Another woman, also black, walks in. It occurs to me that maybe he's not embarrassed about his family. Maybe he's embarrassed about me. Or maybe he's afraid his parents will be ashamed of me. I don't know why I didn't think of this before. America's not really a melting pot. It's more like one of those divided metal plates with separate sections for starch, meat, and veggies. I'm looking at him and he's still not looking at me. Suddenly, we're having a moment I didn't expect.
Hair, an African-American history. In 15th century African civilizations, hairstyles were markers of identity. Hairstyle could indicate everything from tribe or family background to religion to social status. Elaborate hairstyles designated power and wealth. A subdued style could be a sign that you were in a state of mourning. More than that, hair could have spiritual importance. Because it's on your head, the highest part of your body and closest to the skies, many Africans viewed it as a passageway for spirits to the soul, a way to interact with God. That history was erased with the dawn of slavery. On slave ships, newly captured Africans were forcibly shaved in a profound act of dehumanization, an act that effectively severed the link between hair and cultural identity. Post-slavery, African-American hair took on complex associations. Good hair was seen as anything closer to European standards of beauty. Good hair was straight and smooth. Curly, textured hair, the natural hair of many African-Americans, was seen as bad. Straight hair was beautiful. Tightly curled hair was ugly. In the early 1900s, Madam C.J. Walker, an African-American, became a millionaire by inventing and marketing hair care products to black women. Most famously, she improved on the design of the hot comb, a device for straightening hair. In the 1960s, George E. Johnson marketed the relaxer, a chemical product used to straighten otherwise curly African-American hair. According to some estimates, the black hair care industry is worth more than $1 billion annually. Since post-slavery days and through to modern times, debate has raged in the African-American community. What does it mean to wear your hair natural versus straightened? Is straightening your hair a form of self-hatred? Does it mean you think your hair in its natural state is not beautiful? If you wear your hair naturally, are you making a political statement, claiming black power? The way African-American women wear their hair has often been about much more than vanity. It's been about more than just an individual's notion of her own beauty. When Natasha decides to wear hers in an afro, it's not because she's aware of all this history. She does it despite Patricia Kingsley's assertions that afros make women look militant and unprofessional. Those assertions are rooted in fear. Fear that her daughter will be harmed by a society that still so often fears blackness. Patricia also doesn't raise her other objection. Natasha's new hairstyle feels like a rejection. She's been relaxing her own hair all her life. She'd relaxed Natasha's since she was 10 years old. These days, when Patricia looks at her daughter, she doesn't see as much of herself reflected back as before, and it hurts. But of course, all teenagers do this. All teenagers separate from their parents. To grow up is to grow apart. It takes 3 years for Natasha's natural hair to grow in fully. She doesn't do it to make a political statement. In fact, she liked having her hair straight. In the future, she may make it straight again. She does it because she wants to try something new. She does it simply because it looks beautiful.
Area Boy is as big an asshole as his brother. Maybe you could just wait out here, I said, like I'm ashamed of her, like I'm trying to keep her hidden. My regret is instantaneous. No waiting for a few minutes to realize the full impact of my words. Nope, nope, nope. Immediate and all-consuming. And once they're out, I can't believe I said them. Is this what I'm made of? Nothing? I'm a bigger asshole than Charlie. I can't look at her. Her eyes are on my face and I can't look at her. I want that time machine. I want the last minute back. I fucked up. If it's going to be Daniel and Natasha, then dealing with my dad's racism is only the beginning. But she and I are just at the beginning, and I just don't want to have to deal with him right now. I want to do the easy thing, not the right thing. I want to fall in love, with an emphasis on the falling part. No obstacles in the way, please. No one needs to get bruised up falling in love. I just want to fall the way everybody else gets to.
I'll be fine waiting here. I understand. Really, I do. But there's part of me, the part that doesn't believe in God or true love, that really wants him to prove me wrong about not believing in those things. I want him to choose me. Even though it's way too early in the history of us, even though it's not what I would do, I want him to be as noble as he first seemed to be. But of course, he's not. Nobody is. So I let him off his own hook. Don't worry so much, I say. I'll wait.
When you're born, they, God or little aliens or whoever, should send you into the world with a bunch of free passes. A do-over, a rain check, a take-back-see, a get-out-of-jail-free card. I would use my do-over now. I look up at her and realize she knows exactly what I'm going through. She'll understand if I just go inside and hand over the pouch and come back outside. Then we can just continue on our way and I won't have to have any who-was-that-girl conversations later with my dad. No, once you go black cracks from Charlie. This little weirdness will be a small hiccup on our road to greatness, to epic coupledom. But I can't do it. I can't leave her out here. Partly because it's the right thing to do. But mostly because she and I are not really at the beginning. Can I try that again? I ask, deploying my do-over. She smiles so big that I know that whatever happens will be worth it.
A bell chimes as soon as we enter. It's like every other beauty supply store I've ever been in. It's small and crammed with rows of metal shelves, overflowing with plastic bottles, promising that their secret formula is best for your hair, skin, etc. The cash register is right across from the entrance, so I see his father right away. Immediately, I know where Daniel gets his good looks. His dad is older and balding, but he has the same sharp bone structure and perfectly symmetrical face that make Daniel so attractive. He's busy ringing up a customer and doesn't acknowledge Daniel at all, though I'm sure he saw us both. The customer is a boy, around my age, black, with short purple hair, three lip rings, one nose ring, an eyebrow ring, and too many earrings to count. I want to see what he's buying, but it's already bagged. Daniel pulls the pouch from his suit pocket and starts to walk over. His dad gives him a brief glance. I'm not sure what was communicated, but Daniel stops moving and sighs. You need to go to the bathroom or anything? He asks. There's one in the back. I shake my head. He strangles the pouch with his hands. Well, this is it. This is the store. Want to show me around? I ask, to help distract him. Not much to see. First three aisles are for hair. Shampoo, conditioner, extensions, dyes, lots of chemical things I don't understand. Aisle three is makeup. Aisle four is equipment. He glances at his dad, but he's still busy. Do you need something? He asks. I touch my hair. No, I didn't mean a product. We have a fridge in the back with soda and stuff. Sure, I say. I like the idea of seeing behind the scenes. We walk down the hair dye aisle. All the boxes feature broadly smiling women with the most perfectly colored and styled hair. It's not hair dye being sold in these bottles. It's happiness. I stop in front of a group of boxes with brightly colored dyes and pick up a pink one. There's a very small, secret, impractical part of me that's always wanted pink hair. It takes Daniel a few seconds to realize that I've stopped walking. Pink? He asks when he sees the box in my hand. I wiggle it at him. Why not? Doesn't seem like your style. Of course he's completely right, but I hate that he thinks so. Am I too predictable and boring? I think back to the boy I saw when we entered the store. I bet he keeps everyone guessing. Shows how much you know, I say, and pat my hair. His eyes follow my hand. And now I'm really self-conscious and hoping he's not going to ask to touch my hair or a bunch of dumb questions about it. Not that I don't want him to touch my hair, because I do. Just not as a curiosity. I think you would look beautiful with a giant pink afro, he says. Sincerity is sexy, and my cynical heart notices. The whole thing wouldn't be pink. Maybe just the ends. He reaches for the box. So now we're both holding it and facing each other in an aisle that really only has enough space for one. It would look like strawberry frosting, he says. With his other hand, he pulls a few strands of my hair through his fingers, and I find that I don't mind, not one little bit. Oh, look. My little brother is here, says a voice from the end of the aisle. Daniel jerks his hand from my hair. We both let go of the dye at the same time, and the box clatters to the floor. Daniel bends to pick it up. I turn to face our interloper. He's taller and broader than Daniel. On his face, the family bone structure seems even sharper. He rests the broom he was holding against a shelf and saunters down the aisle toward us. His wide, dark eyes are filled with curiosity and a kind of mischievous glee. I'm not sure I like him. Daniel stands up and hands the dye back to me. What's up, Charlie? He asks. The sky is up. Little brother, says Charlie. I get the feeling he's been using that phrase the same way for all their lives. He's looking at me as he says it, and his face is more sneer than smile. Who is this? He asks, still only looking at me. Next to me, Daniel takes a deep breath and readies himself to say something, but I jump in. I'm Natasha. He stares at me as if there must be more to say. A friend of your brother's. I continue.
Oh, I thought maybe he'd caught a shoplifting customer.
His face is a parody of innocence. We get a lot of those in a store like this. His eyes are laughing and mean. I'm sure you understand. I definitely don't like him. Jesus Christ, Charlie, Daniel says. He takes a step toward Charlie, but I grab his hand. He stops and links his fingers with mine and squeezes. Charlie makes a big show of looking down at our joined hands and then back up at us. Is this what I think it is? Is it love, little brother? He claps his hands together with a loud smack and does a laughing two-step dance. This is great. Yes. You know what this means, don't you? All the heat will be off me. When the rents find out about this, I'll be a Boy Scout again. Fuck academic probation. He's laughing loudly now and rubbing his palms together, like a villain detailing his plans for world domination. Wow. You're an asshole, I say, unable to help myself. He smiles as if I've paid him a compliment, but the smile doesn't last long. He looks at our hands again and then at Daniel. You're such a punk, he says. Where are you gonna go with this? I squeeze Daniel's hand tighter and pull it to my side. I want to prove Charlie wrong. Do your thing and let's get out of here, I say. He nods and we turn away and walk right into his father. I pull my hand from his at the same time he's letting mine go, but it's too late. His father's already seen us.
Giant bag of dicks masquerade as teenage boy. Fools exactly no one. Charlie is a giant bag of dicks that I'd like to light on fire. I want to hit him in his perfectly smug face. It's not a new emotion for me, since I've wanted to do it since I was 10, but this time he's finally gone too far. I'm thinking how good it would feel to break my hand on his face, but I'm also focused on the feel of Natasha's hand in mine. I need to get her out of here before my family derails my life just as it's getting started. What are you doing? My father asks in Korean. I decide to ignore the question he's really asking. Instead, I hold out the pouch for him to take. Mom said I had to bring you this. I say it in English so Natasha doesn't think we're talking about her. Charlie sidles up next to me. Want me to help translate for your friend? He asks. He overemphasizes friend, because being a dick on fire is Charlie's raison d'etre. My dad gives him a hard look. I thought you don't understand Korean, he says to Charlie. Charlie shrugs. I get by. Not even my dad's disapproval can stop him from enjoying himself at my expense. Is that why you fail out of Harvard? You only get by? This part he says in Korean because the last thing my dad would want to do is air our dirty laundry in front of a Miguk Saram, an American. Charlie doesn't give a crap and translates anyway, but he's smiling a little less. Don't worry, he says to Natasha. He's not talking about you. Not yet. He's just calling me stupid. Dad's face goes completely blank, so I know he's really angry now. Charlie's got him trapped. Anything he says, Charlie will translate, and my dad's sense of propriety can't allow that to happen. Instead, he turns into deferential store owner like I've seen him do a million times to a million customers. You want something before you leave? He asks Natasha. He clasps his hands, half bends at the waist, and smiles his best customer service smile. No, thank you, Mr. She stops because she doesn't know my last name. My dad doesn't answer. Yes, you friend of Daniel's. Take anything you want. This is an accident in progress, but I don't know how to stop it. He pats at his pockets until he finds his glasses and peers at the bottles on the shelf. Not this aisle, he mutters. Come with me. Maybe if we just go along, this will all be over quickly. Natasha and I follow him helplessly while Charlie laughs. My dad finds what he's looking for one aisle over.
Here, Relaxo for your hair.
He pulls a big black and white tub from a shelf and hands it to Natasha.
Relaxo, he says again. Make your hair not so big.
How was I born into this family and how can I get out of it? Charlie laughs long and loud. I start to say that she doesn't need anything, but Natasha interrupts. Thank you, Mr. Bay, I say, because she should know my last name. Mr. Bay, I don't need any hair too big, he says again. I like it big, she says.
Better get a different boyfriend then, says Charlie.
He waggles his eyebrows to make sure we all get his innuendo. I'm surprised he doesn't follow it up with a hand gesture just to be absolutely clear. My surprise doesn't last because he holds his thumb and forefinger apart by an inch.
Good joke, Charlie, I say.
Yes, my penis is only an inch long. I don't bother to look at my father's face. Natasha turns to me and her mouth actually drops open. She's definitely reconsidering her recent life choices. I practically fling the pouch at my father. Things cannot get any worse, so I reach for her hand despite the fact that my father is standing right there. Mercifully, she lets me take it.
Thank you. Come again,
booms Charlie when we're almost out the door. He's like a pig in shit, or just the shit. I flip him off and ignore the vast disapproval coming from my father, because there'll be time for that later.
I'm laughing, even though I know I shouldn't. That was the most perfectly awful experience. Poor Daniel. Observable fact. Families are the worst. We're almost all the way back to the subway station before he finally stops tugging me along. He slaps a palm against the back of his neck and hangs his head. I'm sorry, he says, so quietly that I more lip-read it than hear it. I'm trying to keep my laughter suppressed because he looks like someone died, but I'm having a hard time. The image of his dad trying to shove the tub of relaxer at me rises in my mind, and the laughter just bubbles out of me. Once I start, I can't stop. I clutch my stomach as hysterics take me over. Daniel just stares at me. His frown is so deep it might become permanent. That was terrible, I say, finally calm. I don't think that could have gone any worse. Racist dad, racist and sexist older brother. Daniel rubs the spot on his neck and frowns some more. And the store, I mean, the ancient posters of those women, and your dad critiquing my hair, and your brother making a small penis joke. By the time I'm done listing all the things that were awful, I'm laughing again. It takes him a few more seconds, but finally he smiles too, and I'm glad for it. I'm glad you think this is funny, he says. Come on, I say, tragedy is funny. Are we in a tragedy? He asks, smiling broadly now. Of course, isn't that what life is? We all die at the end. I guess so, he says. He steps closer, takes my hand, and places it on his chest. I study my nails. I study my cuticles. Anything to avoid looking up into those brown eyes of his. His heart thrums beneath my fingers. Finally, I look up, and he covers my hand with his. I'm sorry, he says. I'm sorry about my family. I nod because the feel of his heartbeat is doing funny things to my vocal cords. I'm sorry about everything, about the whole history of the world and all its racism and the unfairness of all of it. What are you even saying? It's not your fault. You can't apologize for racism. I can, and I do. Jesus, save me from the nice and sincere boys who feel things too deeply. I still think what happened is funny in its perfect awfulness, but I understand his shame, too. It's hard to come from some place or someone you're not proud of. You're not your dad, I say, but he doesn't believe me. I understand his fear. Who are we if not a product of our parents and their histories?
Hair, A Korean-American History. Daniel's family did not enter the black hair care business by chance. When Dae-hyun and Min-soo moved to New York City, there was an entire community of fellow South Korean immigrants waiting to help them. Dae-hyun's cousin gave them a loan and advised them to open a black hair care store. His cousin had a similar store, as did many other immigrants in his new community. The stores were thriving. The dominance of South Koreans in the black hair care industry also did not happen by chance. It began in the 1960s with the rise in popularity of wigs made with South Korean hair in the African American community. The wigs were so popular that the South Korean government banned the export of raw hair from its shores. This ensured that wigs featuring South Korean hair could only be made in South Korea. At the same time, the U.S. government banned the import of wigs that contained hair from China. Those two actions effectively solidified the dominance of South Korea in the wig market. The wig business naturally evolved to the more general black hair care business. It's estimated that South Korean businesses control between 60% and 80% of that market, including distribution, retail, and increasingly, manufacturing. Be it for cultural reasons or for racial ones, this dominance in distribution makes it nearly impossible for any other group to gain a foothold in the industry. South Korean distributors primarily distribute to South Korean retailers, effectively shutting everyone else out of the market. Dae-hyun is not aware of any of this history. What he knows is this. America is the land of opportunity. His children will have more than he once did.
I want to thank her for not hating me. After that experience in my parents' store, who could blame her? Also, she didn't need to react to my family as peacefully as she did. If she'd yelled at both my brother and my dad, I would have understood. It's a miracle, water into wine variety, that she's still willing to hang out with me, and I'm more than grateful for it. Instead of saying all that, I ask her if she wants to get some lunch. We're back at the subway entrance, and all I want to do is get as far away from the store as possible. If the D-Line went to the moon, I'd buy a ticket. I'm starving, I say. She rolls her eyes. Starving? Really? You have a penchant for exaggeration. It's to offset your precision. Do you have a place in mind? She asks. I suggest my favorite restaurant in Koreatown, and she agrees. We find side-by-side seats on the train and settle in. It'll take 40 minutes to get all the way back downtown. I take out my phone to find more questions. Ready for more? I ask her. She slides closer to me so our shoulders are pressed together and peers down at my phone. She's so close, her hair tickles my nose. I can't help it. I take what I think is a discreet sniff of her hair that is not discreet at all. She scoots away from me, eyes wide and mortified. Did you just smell me? She asks. She touches the section of hair where my nose just was. I don't know what to say. If I admit it, I'm creepy and weird. If I deny it, I'm a liar and creepy and weird. She pulls the strands that she's touching across her nose and sniffs at it herself. Now, I need to make sure that she doesn't think I think her hair smells bad. No, I mean, yes. Yes, I smelled it. I stop talking because her eyes have gone wider than I should be able to go. And? She prompts. It takes me a second to work out what she's asking. It smells good.
You know, sometimes in spring when it rains just for like 5 minutes and then the sun comes out right away and the water's evaporating and the air is still damp? It smells like that. Really good. I make my mouth close even though it just wants to keep talking. I look back down at my phone and wait, hoping she'll come close again.
He thinks my hair smells like spring rain. I'm really trying to remain stoic and unaffected. I remind myself that I don't like poetic language. I don't like poetry. I don't even like people who like poetry. But I'm not dead inside either.
She comes close again, and I barrel ahead. Because apparently that's who I am with this girl. Maybe part of falling in love with someone else is also falling in love with yourself. I like who I am with her. I like that I say what's on my mind. I like that I barrel ahead despite the obstacles she raises. Normally I would give up, but not today. I raise my voice over the clacking of the train against the tracks. Right, on to section 2. I look up from my phone. Ready for this? We're leveling up on the intimacy. She frowns at me, but still nods. I read the questions aloud, and she chooses number 24. How do you feel about your relationship with your mother and father? You have to go first, she says. Well, you met my dad. I don't even know where to begin with this question. Of course I love him. But you can love someone and still have a not-so-great relationship with them. I wonder how much of our non-relationship is because of typical father versus teenage boy stuff, a 10 o'clock curfew, really, and how much of it is cultural, Korean-Korean versus Korean-American. I don't know if it's even possible to separate the two. Sometimes I feel like we're on opposite sides of a soundproofed glass wall. We can see each other, but we can't hear each other. So you feel bad then, she teases. I laugh because it's such a simple and concise way to describe something so complicated. The train breaks suddenly and jostles us even closer together. She doesn't move away. And your mom? She asks. Pretty good, I say, and I realize that I mean it. She's kind of like me. She paints, she's artistic. Funny. I've never thought of us being the same in this way before. Now your turn. She looks at me. Remind me again why I agreed to this. Wanna stop? I ask, even though I know she'll say no. She's the kind of person who finishes what she starts. I'll make it easy on you. You can just give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down, okay? She nods. Mom? I ask. Thumbs up. Way up? Let's not go overboard. I'm 17 and she's my mom, she says. Dad? Thumbs down. Way down? I ask. Way, way, way down.
It's hard to love someone who doesn't love you back, I tell him. He opens his mouth and then closes it again. He wants to tell me that of course my father loves me. All parents love their children, he wants to say. But that's not true. Nothing is ever universal. Most parents love their children. It's true that my mother loves me. Here is another thing that's also true. I am my father's greatest regret. How do I know? He said so, himself.
Samuel Kingsley, A History of Regret, Part 2. Samuel Kingsley was certain being famous was his destiny. Surely God wouldn't have gifted him with all this talent with no place to display it. And then Patricia came along. Surely God wouldn't have given him a beautiful wife and children if he didn't mean to provide for them. Samuel remembers the moment he met her, They were still in Jamaica, in Montego Bay. It had been raining outside, one of those tropical storms that start as suddenly as they stop. He'd ducked into a clothing store for shelter so he wouldn't be soaked for his audition. She was the store manager, so the first time he saw her, she was wearing a name tag and looking very official. Her hair was short and curly, and she had the biggest, prettiest, shyest eyes he'd ever seen. He never could resist a shy girl. All that caution and mystery. He'd quoted Bob Marley and Robert Frost. He'd sung. Patricia never stood a chance against the force of his charm. His audition time came and went, but he didn't care. He couldn't get enough of those eyes that widened so dramatically at the slightest flirtation. Still, a part of him had said to stay away. Some prescient part of him saw the two paths diverging in the yellow wood. Maybe if he'd chosen the other path, if he'd left the store instead of stayed, it would have made all the difference.
Korean food? Best food. Healthy. Good for you, I say to Natasha, imitating my mom. It's something she says every time we go out to dinner. Charlie always suggests we go to an American place, but Mom and Dad always take us to Korean, even though we eat Korean food at home every day. I don't mind because it turns out I agree with my mom. Korean food? Best food. Natasha and I don't have much time left before her appointment, and I'm beginning to doubt that I can make her fall in love with me in the next couple of hours. But I can at least make her want to see me again tomorrow. We walk into my favorite sundubu joint to greetings of 안녕하세요 from the staff. I love this place, and their seafood stew is almost as good as my mom's. It's not fancy at all, just small wooden tables in the center surrounded by booths on the perimeter. It's not crowded right now, so we manage to snag a booth. Natasha asks me to order for her. I'll eat whatever you tell me to, she says. I ring the little bell attached to the table, and a waitress appears almost instantly. I order two seafood sundubu, kalbi, and pajeon. There's a bell? She asks after the waitress leaves. Awesome, right? We're a practical people, I say, only half kidding. Takes all the mystery out of food service. When will my waiter appear? When will I get the check? Do American restaurants know about this? Because we should tell them. Bells should be mandatory. I laugh and agree, but then she takes it back. No, I changed my mind. Can you imagine some jerk just leaning on the bell demanding ketchup? The banchan, complimentary side dishes, arrive almost immediately. A part of me braces to have to explain to her what she's eating. Once, a friend of a friend made a, "What's in this food? Is it dog?" joke. I felt like shit, but still I laughed. It's one of those moments that makes me want that do-over card. Natasha, though, doesn't ask any questions about the food. The waitress comes over and hands us both chopsticks. "Oh, can I have a fork, please?" Natasha asks. The waitress gives her a disapproving look and turns to me. "Teach girlfriend how to use chopsticks," she says and walks away. Natasha looks at me with wide eyes. Does that mean she's not going to bring me a fork? I laugh and shake my head. What the hell? "I guess you should teach me how to use chopsticks," she says. "Don't worry about her," I say. "Some people aren't happy until everything is done their way." She shrugs. Every culture is like that. The Americans, the French, the Jamaicans, the Koreans. Everyone thinks their way is the best way. Us Koreans might actually be right, though, I say, grinning. The waitress returns and places the soup and two uncooked eggs in front of us. She tosses paper-clad spoons into the center of the table. "What's this called?" Natasha asks when the waitress is out of earshot. "Sundubu," I say.
She watches me crack my egg into the soup and bury it under cubes of steaming tofu and shrimp and clams so it will cook. She does the same and doesn't make a comment about whether it's safe to eat. "This is delicious," she says, sipping a spoonful. She practically wiggles with pleasure. "How come you call yourself Korean?" she asks after a few more sips. "Weren't you born here?" "Doesn't matter. People always ask where I'm from. I used to say here, but then they ask where are you really from, and then I say Korea. Sometimes I say North Korea, and that my parents and I escaped from a water dungeon filled with piranhas where Kim Jong-un was holding us prisoner." She doesn't smile like I expect her to. She just asks me why I do that. "Because it doesn't matter what I say. People take one look at me and believe what they want." "That sucks," she says, scooping up some kimchi and popping it into her mouth. I could watch her eat all day. "I'm used to it. My parents think I'm not Korean enough. Everybody else thinks I'm not American enough." "That really sucks." She moves on from the kimchi to bean sprouts. "I don't think you should say you're from Korea, though." "Why not?" "Because it's not true. You're from here." I love how simple this is for her. I love that her solution to everything is to tell the truth. I struggle with my identity, and she tells me just to say what's true. "It's not up to you to help other people fit you into a box," she says. "Do people do it to you?" "Yeah, except I'm really not from here, remember? We moved here when I was 8. I had an accent. The first time I saw snow, I was in homeroom, and I was so amazed I stood up to stare at it." "Oh, no." "Oh, yes," she says. "Did the other kids?" "It wasn't pretty." She mock shivers at the memory. "Want to hear something even worse? My first spelling quiz, the teacher marked that I spelled favorite wrong because I included the U." "That is wrong." "Nope." She waves her spoon at me. "The correct English spelling includes the U. So saith the Queen of England. Look it up, American boy." Anyway, I was such a little nerd that I went home and brought her the dictionary and got my points back. "You didn't." "I did," she says, smiling. "You really wanted those points." "Those points were mine." She giggles then, which is not a thing I thought she did. Of course, I've only known her for a few hours, so obviously I don't know everything about her yet. I love this part of getting to know someone. How every new piece of information, every new expression seems magical. I can't imagine this becoming old and boring. I can't imagine not wanting to hear what she has to say. "Stop doing that," she says. "What?" "Staring at me." "Okay," I say. I unearth my egg and see that it's cooked perfectly to a soft boil. "Let's eat them together," I tell her. "It's the best part." She scoops hers out, and now we're both sitting there, egg and spoon, spoon in hand. On three. 1, 2, 3. We pop the eggs into our mouths. I watch as her eyes widen. I know the moment the yolk bursts in her mouth. She closes her eyes like this is the most delicious thing she's ever tasted. She said not to stare, but I'm staring. I love the way she seems to feel things with her entire body. I wonder why a girl who is so obviously passionate is so adamantly against passion.
The Waitress, A History of Love. Learn how to use chopsticks. Teach girlfriend how to use chopsticks. My son, he did the same thing. He date white girl. My husband, he don't accept it. At first, I agree with him. We don't speak to our son for a year after he told us. I thought, we don't talk to him. Make him see reason. Come to senses. We don't talk, and I miss him. I miss my little boy and his American jokes and the way he pinched my cheeks and tell me I'm the prettiest of all the Omas. My son, who was never embarrassed of me when all the other boys get too American. We don't talk to him for over a year. Finally, when he call, I think this is it. He finally understand. White girl will never understand us, never be Korean. But only call to say he's getting married. He wants us to come to wedding. I hear in his voice how much he loves her. I hear how he loves her more than me. I hear that if I don't go to his wedding, I will lose my only son. My only son, who loves me. But Daddy say no. My son begged us to come, and I say no until he stopped begging. He got married. I saw pictures on the Facebook. They are first son. I saw pictures on the Facebook. They have another child, a girl this time, my Sonja, and I only know them from computer. Now when these boys come in here with these girls who don't look like their omas, I get angry. This country try to take everything from you. Your language, your food, your children. Learn how to use chopsticks. This country can't have everything.
Just under 2 hours to go before my appointment, and Daniel really wants to go to Norebang, which is the Korean word for karaoke. Karaoke is itself the Japanese word for embarrassing oneself by singing in front of a room filled with strangers who are only there to laugh at you. It's not like the American version, he insists when I balk. This is much more civilized. By civilized, he means that you embarrass yourself in a small, private room in front of only your friends instead. His favorite norebang place is coincidentally right next door to where we've just had lunch. It's owned and operated by the same people, so we don't even have to go outside, because there's an entrance inside the restaurant. Daniel chooses one of the smallest rooms, but it's still big. They're clearly meant to accommodate parties of 6 or 8 instead of just 2. The room is dimly lit, and plush red leather couches line most of the perimeter. A large square coffee table sits just in front of the couches. On it, there's a microphone, a complicated-looking remote, and a thick book that has Song Menu written on the cover in 3 languages. Next to the door, there's a large TV where the lyrics will appear. A disco ball hangs from the ceiling. Bev would love this place. First, she has kind of an obsession with disco balls. She has 4 hanging from the ceiling of her room and a disco ball lamp slash clock contraption. Second, she's got a great voice and will take any excuse to use it in front of groups of people. I check my phone for more texts from her, but there's nothing. She's just busy, I tell myself. She hasn't forgotten about me already. I'm still here. Daniel closes the door. I can't believe you've never been to Norebang, he says. Shocking, I know, I say back. With the door closed, the room feels small and intimate. He gives me a look like he's thinking the same thing. Let's get some dessert, he says, and presses a button on the wall for service. The same waitress from the restaurant appears to take our order. She doesn't bother to look at me. Daniel orders us patbingsu, which turns out to be shaved ice with fruit, small, soft rice cakes, and sweet red beans. Like it? He asks. It's important to him that I do. I finish it in 6 spoonfuls. What's not to like? It's sweet and cold and delicious. He beams at me, and I beam back. Observable fact. I like making him happy. observable fact. I don't know when that happened. He grabs the song menu from the table and flips to the English section. While he agonizes over song choice, I watch the K-pop videos playing on the television. They're candy-colored and infectious. Just choose a song, I tell him when the third video starts.
This is Noribang, he says. You don't just choose a song. A song chooses you.
Tell me you're kidding, I say. He winks at me and begins loosening his tie.
Yes, I'm kidding, but pipe down. I'm trying to find something to properly impress you with my vocal stylings.
He unbuttons the top button of his shirt. I watch his hands as he pulls the tie off over his head. It's not like he's taking his clothes off. It's not like he's getting undressed right here in front of me. But it feels like he is. I can't see anything scandalous, just a quick glimpse of the skin at his throat. He pulls the rubber band from his hair and tosses it to the table. His hair is just long enough to fall into his face, and he brushes it behind his ears absentmindedly. I can't help staring. It feels like I've been waiting for him to do this all day. Observable fact. He is pretty hot with his hair down. Observable fact. He's pretty hot with his hair up, too. I pull my eyes away and stare at the air conditioner on the wall instead. I'm considering adjusting the temperature down. He rolls up his sleeves, which makes me laugh. He's acting like we're about to engage in serious physical labor. I'm trying not to notice the long, smooth lines of his forearms, but my eyes keep traveling over them. Are you a good singer? I ask. He looks at me with mock solemnity, but his dancing eyes give him away.
Not gonna lie, he says. I am good. Italian opera singer good.
He grabs the remote to key in his song choice.
Are you?
He asks. I don't answer. He'll find out soon enough. In fact, my singing will definitely cure him of the crush he has on me. Observable fact. I am the worst singer on earth. He stands up and walks to the open area in front of the television. Apparently, he's going to need space to maneuver. He adjusts his stance until his feet are planted wide, bows his head so that his hair obscures his face, and holds the microphone up in the air in one hand. Classic rock star pose. It's Take a Chance on Me by ABBA. He puts a hand over his heart and croons the first verse. A la the song title, it's all about taking chances, specifically me taking a chance on him. By the second verse, he's warmed up and throwing me cheesy pop star looks with eyebrow raises, penetrating stares and pouty lips. According to the lyrics, we can do so many fun things as long as we're together. The fun things include dancing, walking, talking, and listening to music. Strangely, there's no mention of kissing. He pantomimes each activity like some sort of deranged mime. And I can't stop laughing. Verse 3 has him down on his knees in front of me. There's something in the lyrics about feeling all alone when pretty birds have flown that I don't quite understand. Am I the bird? Is he? Why are there birds? For the rest of the song, he's back up on his feet, gripping the microphone with both hands and singing with abandon. My hysterical laughter doesn't faze him. Also, he wasn't kidding about being a good singer. He's excellent. He even does his own backing vocals, which consist of him singing Take a Chance over and over again. And it's not like he's trying to be sexy. It's just funny. So funny that it becomes sexy. I didn't know funny could do that. I noticed the way his dress shirt stretches across his chest as he does his disco moves. I notice how long his fingers are when he runs his hands through his hair dramatically. I notice how nice and firm his butt looks in his suit pants. Observable fact. I have a thing.